Good evening, I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas. Where there is no vision, the people perish. This quotation from the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament is at the nub of tonight's program, a starting point for the first of a two-part series. Many Canadian artists have had visions, mystical moments which led to important innovations in the making of their art. The painter Lauren Harris called his The Logic of Ecstasy. He spent almost 40 years making non-objective, abstract canvases, squiggles of brightly colored geometry, paintings rarely exhibited now. They're invisible to most Canadians. Looking at them, it's as if Lauren Harris, honored member of the Group of Seven, never made those cherished paintings of our northern landscape. So where did these impressions come from? Wilderness can be a state of mind, and Harris may have drawn his inspiration from the rivers of the imagination, the streams of consciousness known to First Nations people, a landscape filled with spirits. He may have painted exactly what he actually saw there. His abstractions may in fact be the shadows cast by the spirit world. Tonight, the host of Tapestry, Don Hill, invites you on a journey into the dreamland of visions and voices. A journey from rock paintings made before memory begins to the abstract art of our time.
We're surrounded by magic, invisible forces. This broadcast, for instance, where's my voice coming from? And if you turn off the technology, the receiver, where does the story go? I'm flying. The summer of 2000, I was invited north of latitude 55 to a remote rock art location in northern Saskatchewan. The Indian paintings are ancient, my host Cliff Spear promised. The pictographs, as they're known to archaeology, are prominent along a rock face that's part of the Churchill River system. They're hard to get to and rarely seen, he said. With a canoe lashed to the side of our Beaver, a legendary bush plane, we literally flew off into the wild blue yonder. Rivers, lakes, lots and lots of blue, clipping along a few hundred feet over the tops of trees and barefaced rock that makes up the Cambrian Shield. An hour or so later, the plane descended upon Hixson Lake, a location held sacred by some woodland Cree, and known to the few natives who still remember as a place of power. I've been joined by a few other paddlers. There are nine of us in all.
I'm Bonnie Hamilton. I'm from La Ronge area. I was raised in the Lower Foster area, and I've always been interested in coming here.
Bonnie is a First Nations woodland Cree. She's also a storyteller in the oral tradition. Her impressions speak to the spirit of the land.
I always feel in awe when I see paintings or artifacts done by people long ago, because I feel that they are threads to our past. In Cree, rocks are animate. Rocks are alive. So rocks give off an energy. It also makes me very grateful. I'm always astounded at what they've done. And it's a thought-provoking area.
The repetitive beat, paddle in, paddle out, is trance-like. And it would be easy to lapse into a meditation were it not for the pull of the vista beckoning on the horizon. Paddle, paddle, paddle over more open water. Then we veer off into a channel. On the left flank, a cliff face rises straight up from the water. The right shore, not as vertical, yet equally spectacular, looks like a natural cathedral setting. Yes, the whole place has a churchy feel to it. Hardly a sound, other than the wind. An occasional squawk from a distant raven. There they are, on the left, my companion points, breaking the silence. Sketched in a red ochre, 2 to 3 feet above the waterline, are simple, childlike depictions of animals, people, the sun, and perhaps the moon. Faded by time and weather, some of the pictographs aren't much to look at, but to someone in the know, these are images of the spirit.
My name's Tim Jones. a number of possible explanations have been posited for the creation of the rock art of the Canadian Shield.
Tim is the executive director of the Saskatchewan Archaeological Society. He's also the author of several technical papers on rock art.
The most likely origin or reason for the creation of the paintings has to do with spirituality and the use or the creation of the paintings by shamans, as people with special skills, special insights, and using medicine in the broad sense of the word.
Over a quarter mile stretch are dozens of pictographs, most of them congregated along gallery-like faces of rock. The majority must have been painted from a canoe because they're only accessible by water. There are images on the ledges higher up, but only a handful. All of the paintings are in red ochre. They could be hundreds, perhaps 1,000 years old or more. Their true age, Tim tells me, has been disguised by a thin film of mineral deposits which coat and protect the images during spring runoff. It's not even clear what the pictographs are all about, although Bonnie Hamilton recognizes some universal themes.
It was a man changing into an animal, and I don't know how to translate the Cree word, but it's Bwaganag, and I felt that it was his helper. They come to you in your dreams and help you and give you strength. And that's what I felt those were. And there was two of them on the rocks that I found, but they were far apart, and they were pretty neat. If you were much more powerful, like a medicine man, you could send your dream speaker to battle for you, like, let's say, against another medicine man or against somebody who was not nice to you in some way. So it's something sort of unsaid.
Basically, you've got art that's standing up, literally, in space. It's not buried. You can't excavate it. You've got very big problems with dating and so on. But it's out there. And what do you do with it? How do you reconstruct what happened when that particular set of paintings or that set of carvings was made?
Tim Jones is careful not to label the rock art with a specific interpretation. He has to be. Within the academic discipline of archaeology, the profession has only grudgingly acknowledged pictographs as a marker to the divine, and they continue to be a source of controversy.
A lot of the world's rock art in the past has been explained away as hunting magic, sympathetic magic. It's an old notion that comes actually from Europe, from some of the first studies of the cave art when it was discovered late in the last century. That was one of the main hypotheses that developed, and it's really stuck around for a long time, and it shouldn't have.
I have not tried interpreting them in any way. I merely look at them in awe, and I think of what reality could have been for them at that time, and what my reality is now. But there's a few that are still carried through, like the theme of the Thunderbird. Women, men, animals. Those themes carry on in throughout our lives. And so it's sort of a thread to the past, but it's also a curiosity.
Well, some of the animals they're depicting are real animals. If you can call a stick figure of a moose a real animal. But others are definitely not something that you would see unless under certain special circumstances.
South African archaeologists David Lewis Williams and Thomas Dowson first proposed that Aboriginal rock art found in locations around the world were made by shamans in an altered state of consciousness. Writing their dreams upon the rock marked the outcome of their vision quest. Kevin Callahan is a graduate student at the University of Minnesota. His master's thesis was on shamanism and Native American pictographs and petroglyphs. Pictographs are found painted over the rock and petroglyphs carved into it. I called him up at his home in Minneapolis-St. Paul.
It was very important for someone who was on a vision quest to remember the dream because it was a gift from the other world, and it was part of the power. So when you were gaining power by going on a vision quest and gaining information, you had to remember it. Well, as everybody knows, you know, when you wake up from a dream, you tend to forget it unless you write it down. So there's some indication that the petroglyphs were quickly hacked out in order to remember both what was in the vision and also the spot where it was gained and where that power came from, so that if you were going to go back to that spot to have a contact with the other world or spirit world, that you could go back to the spot where you had that vision.
If it's true that the images are depictions of what the shamans actually saw during trance, then much of it looks like entoptic imagery.
Well, entoptic, it's a Greek word, and basically it means within or behind the eye.
Dave Whitley is a professor of archaeology at UCLA. He's the leading authority on California rock art.
And it refers to the fact that in certain circumstances, our optical system in our brain will generate imagery internal to itself. We'll interpret those as being things we're seeing, but we're not really seeing them in the outside world. They're in our brain.
Entoptic images are geometric shapes, zigzags, wavy lines, visual dits and dots, and crosshatches like a grid for a game of X's and O's. They're part of the brain's underlying architecture for sight.
Now, the circumstances under which those are generated commonly would include a trance, an altered state of consciousness or a hallucination, a blow to the head, a migraine headache perhaps, or even we can generate them if we stare at a bright light and close our eyes and then press our eyelids. We'll see those geometric patterns.
The other thing that truly is universal are the existence of phosphenes or photisms.
Maureen Korp teaches art history and religious studies at Carleton University. Dr. Korp has visited rock art sites around the world.
And those are those little squiggly squiggles and the lines and the dots and things that you find in a hypnagogic state, which is where your brain is as you're about to fall off to sleep. You know, your eyes are closed and you're seeing these little bright splotches. Sometimes, not all the times, but sometimes. Or if you're not wearing contact lenses, you could do this right now. Close your eyes and press very lightly on the eyelid, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Those squiggles show up everywhere, and they show up on pottery, they show up in embroidery, they show up on the walls of Lascaux. The question is, what do they mean? But the form itself, that's the human being making it.
Well, I think it's quite clear if you look at indigenous drawings and just ancient drawings going back to caveman days, a lot of it is imagery which simply naturally seems to flow out of the brain in altered states. So it is not surprising to me that some images, certain swirls, certain boxes and so on, are considered archetypal because they're actually as archetypal as you can get. They're coming out of the neural structure of the body itself.
Dean Radin, author of The Conscious Universe. You'll be hearing more from Dr. Radin and Dr. Korp later in the series. Our canoes slip silently past each pictograph, from panel to panel, until we come alongside a large crack in the rock, a geophysical fault which frames an arch in the cliff face. It's like a small grotto, but large enough to shelter one canoe. Yet I am not alone here. From the inside looking out, a pictograph outlines a solo paddler in another vessel, the bow pointing out from the rock toward the channel, as if heading out of a portal. Dave Whitley.
Native Americans actually are quite specific about the cracks. Quite simply, they're the doors to the supernatural. When the shaman went into a trance, it was said the cracks would open up and he would walk in. One of the results is we do sometimes find offerings that are probably prehistoric in age that were left in these cracks. The cracks were essentially the doorway. You leave an offering in that crack, and it's like leaving a present on the doorstep of the spirit that's inside.
Everyone left an offering along the ledge, our canoes hugging the cliff face on the waterline. Cliff Spear laid out a pouch of tobacco. I set aside 3 stones, purple amethysts from northern Ontario. One of them slipped out of my hand, fell into the depths. The loud splash kind of startled me. The sound here has a tightness to it. The water lapping between the canoe and the wall of the rock gives off an odd splooshing sound, a peculiar echo. Repetitive sounds, prolonged rounds of drumming, chanting, are known to induce trance. The flicker and dance of shadows from a fire. Deep breathing, too. It's said the rock paintings will speak to those who listen, reveal its secrets to those who can see. In the second stage of trance, cartoon-like figures appear, animated in some instances, pulsating as if alive. The third stage is somatic, says Kevin Callahan. Your body stretches out of shape as you start to fly around or dig deep into the ground. You can morph. Extra fingers or toes show up. You might even turn into an animal, like a wolf or bear. Feel your whole body change. And it all seems very real, Kevin said. Here, along the channel near Hixon Lake in northern Saskatchewan, several of the pictographs remind me of the shapeshifters Kevin described. Bonnie Hamilton.
I felt it was a person coming out of the animal and changing back to a person. And I don't think of it as a shapeshifter. I think of it more on a mental plane, not physically changing, but mentally changing. And I think by having a boagan, you have the power to be able to move, but using your brain. That's what I tend to think.
Over the years, I've visited several rock art locations, recorded my travels on film and video. The remarkable thing about pictographs and petroglyphs is how similar they look around the world. The entoptic imagery appears to jump between cultures, even when distance and chronology have deemed it impossible for civilizations to have had contact with each other. It's like some kind of strong magic has been invoked. The same visions arise, and the same story remains to be seen again and again. Modern science verifies this. Medical research has determined all human beings have common experiences in altered states of consciousness. The content of the dreamlike states may differ, but the process of human perception in trance is the same. Kevin Callahan is expert on the rock art of Minnesota.
Well, I think human beings are, generally speaking, wired similarly in terms of our neurology. And the experiments that have been done by the medical community indicates that there's some common patterns to what we all perceive as we go through the stages into deeper altered states of consciousness. So some people, however, are better at going into altered states than others, and those people tended to become shamans. If you ask people around you that you know what experiences they've had with things like encounters with unexplained phenomenon, frequently those things can be explained through the medical model, but most people who actually experience them believe they're real because their senses tell them that what they're experiencing is real. So I don't know, I can't really be disparaging in any way of people who believe that the experiences that they've had are real. And there's a lot of research on this that indicates that sometimes people firmly believe something to be true, which an independent observer watching them would indicate is not true. For example, in the Middle Ages, witches believed that they flew on broomsticks, and that was a result of atropine, which was ingested through the skin. And there were people standing right over them who watched them throughout the whole process, and they could not convince them that they had not gone flying on a broomstick, even though they had been standing over them from the beginning of the process of entering altered states until they came out of it. So it's two views of the same experience, one from the outside and one from the inside.
Tim Jones.
In the rock art of Texas, for example, and Southern California, there's some unbelievable polychromatic art that archaeologists have shown is really directly connected to taking of substances that cause hallucinations. And what the people are depicting there are actual visions or things that they're seeing in real life, so to speak, really colorful things that you're seeing right before your eyes.
Are these rock art depictions of what the shaman actually saw?
Well, the depictions could be of things that were seen during altered states of consciousness. The most common instructions would follow something like this. They'd say, well, you should go out to the vision quest site and stay awake for about 4 days. And during that time period, you would smoke tobacco, fast, and pray, and so forth. And the medical studies that have been done with college students have indicated that if after 4 days of intense concentration and staying awake, that they would see things like people that weren't really there. They'd see the room kind of break up into little particles and start shimmering. And so the instructions for the vision quest pretty much parallel what medical doctors have found when they've had subjects go through sleep deprivation.
Also sounds like a pathology.
Well, it isn't a pathology. What it is the altered state of consciousness is like a waking dream. So in your brainstem, you have, it's like a light switch that goes on and off. And if you can toggle that so that you're conscious while you're dreaming, you have the equivalent of a hallucination or a waking dream. And this has been used by other modern artists. For example, Salvador Dali is an example of someone who would have an assistant wake him up when he went into rapid eye movement sleep, or the period of sleep when you're dreaming. And when he would wake up, he'd be having a waking dream. He'd be hallucinating. And then he used those images in his artwork.
Kevin Callahan. We need to stay awake to dream, to remember, to become aware of the shadows of the spirit. Before the advent of photography, the visual arts were preoccupied with making faithful depictions of the landscape. They called it representational art. Realism, captured by a simple snapshot, liberated painters to look elsewhere. And by the late 19th century, the canon of Western art was beginning to look quite different. Things began to blur. Impressions became paramount. Stimulants like laudanum and absinthe were the potions of choice, and some of the artwork began to reflect those choices. The unconscious was new territory, and Sigmund Freud and Carl Gustav Jung staked claims on the real estate once held exclusively by religion. The fathers of psychiatry and modern psychology spoke to the artists of their day, presented them with a challenge to go into the mindscape and capture it to canvas and musical score. It was a small book, well under 100 pages, but when Concerning the Spiritual in Art was published in 1912, it caused a sensation, a revolution in art. Representational painting was dead. Long live non-objective art. That message was delivered by Vasily Kandinsky, an aristocrat of Russian heritage who made his mark in Munich, one of the great centers for cultural pursuits before the First World War. Kandinsky's paintings are world famous. They're abstract, the art historians assure us, non-objective. But to my eye, the geometric shapes, lines, even some of the colors, bear a stunning resemblance to rock art. Did Kandinsky paint what he actually saw? And what did he really mean by the title of his manifesto concerning the spiritual in art? I've only read the book in English translation. It was originally published in German as Über das Geistige in der Kunst. The word Geistige casts several shadows. It can literally mean ghost or spirit, as getting into the spirit of things. Das Geistige can also mean the unknown. Sharon Udall is an art historian. She's expert in 19th and 20th century art and teaches at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque.
Spiritual is the translator's word here. We know that Kandinsky's book, for example, had several different titles in translation, and it depends on what your emphasis might be. I don't think he meant it so much as spiritual in the context of religious, which is what we modern-day Americans and maybe Canadians want to connect, but that rather it is the realm of mind and imagination as divorced from physical, touchable, positivist reality that we're talking about here. But I do think that Kandinsky believed that there was an important spiritual underpinning possible in art, and that an artist who wanted to could access some of that information. And in fact, he talked about the coming age in art when the spiritual could be made visible, and that this is the real task of the artist, is to try to make visible that which might be only partially perceived now or invisible, and that this was the untouched realm that artists could have access to. So he thought through such stimuli as vibrations or color, which was a very important element for Kandinsky, that an artist could transfer or translate emotion into visual form.
Painters who had been confined to representing three-dimensional space now began to think about a fourth dimension as a possible realm for contemplation. What might a fourth dimension look like? Visual artists asked among themselves. How would it feel? What might it sound like? The hotbed for music and artistic expression was Europe, in particular France and Germany, an exciting place for a young Canadian in his early 20s to study. His name was Lauren Harris. Lauren Harris absorbed the sights and sounds of Europe and its revolutionary ideas about visual art. In 1913, he visited New York and the Armory Show, which introduced North Americans to non-objective art. Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase was a scandal and a revelation. And a year later, the slaughter of the First World War changed everything again. With much of Europe in ruins, Lauren Harris tumbled and fell into a deep depression following the death of his brother on the killing fields. It was 1918, and he turned to theosophy as a way out of his despair. Theosophy is a kind of stew of the world's great religions. Its founder, Madame Blavatsky, braided principles of Eastern mysticism, Buddhist and Hindu beliefs, with elements of Western scientific thought. The result was an attractive argument for the evolution of consciousness and the idea that spirit was ever-present and everlasting. Theosophy had a profound influence on the leading people of the day. Artists like Kandinsky and Piet Mondrian were followers, and by the end of the 1920s, theosophy had perpetuated itself in the art world to the point where people could be talking its principles and not know it. Lauren Harris was particularly attracted to the theosophical notion that nature is more profound than science can explain, and that spirituality is present in everything, an affirmation in many respects of a First Nations outlook on the world. Madame Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophical movement, once claimed that hidden in the vastness of the Rocky Mountains lies a secret sanctuary where ancient adepts and sages live to this day, preserving the secret doctrine and guiding the destiny of the planet. Lauren Harris believed this was true. Just prior to his journey west to the Rockies on a painting expedition in 1924, and after a long flirtation, Lauren Harris officially joined the Toronto Theosophical Society. By this time, the mystical sect, whose followers in Canada were in the thousands, counted among its numbers the elite of Toronto society, business, and the arts. On one of his many trips hiking above the tree line along mountaintops, Lauren Harris fell into a trance-like state, then babbled incomprehensibly in a strange language. His sketching companion, Bertram Charles Binning, B.C. to his friends, was witness to a surreal outburst of glossolalia, better known as speaking in tongues. This experience, coupled with other extraordinary events, pushed Lauren Harris to reject some of the responsibilities imposed by his status as a wealthy man of privilege. And in 1934, he walked away from his marriage to Trixie, his wife of many, many years. He walked away from social convention and married his best friend's wife. He walked away from Toronto and scandal and ran toward an indistinct call, fumbling, bumping along his way toward enlightenment as if it was a location, hanging on to anyone he encountered who might know of the way. Ann Davis is a professor of art history at the University of Calgary. She's the author of The Logic of Ecstasy, Canadian Mystical Painting, 1920 to 1940.
Lauren Harris, the very famous Canadian painter and thinker, started off as a painter, painting recognizable forms. However, by the mid-1930s, he started painting abstractions. He had a whole lot of trouble getting into this. So Harris tried to parse abstraction. He tried to figure out what Kandinsky and these other Europeans were doing and why they were doing it. He wrestled with this. And I'd like, if I may, to read you a little bit of this wrestle. Harris had some wonderful correspondence with Emily Carr. And in a letter to Emily Carr after a 1930 trip that Harris took to Europe, he talked about the differences between European and North American art. And in specific, he talked about this problem of his not being sure about the validity of abstraction. So he wrote to Carr, "I cannot yet feel that abstract painting has greater possibilities of depth and meaning than art based on nature and natural forms. As you say, it so frequently becomes arid. But of course it need not. I have seen almost no abstract things that have deep resonance that stirs and answers and satisfies the soul, however. But that doesn't say that some painter may not produce them tomorrow or the next day. To you and me and others, the representational as representational means nothing, the spirit everything. But we cannot get the spirit without the use of representation in some degree." So what I think that Harris is saying here is, first of all, he's not interested in trees and mountains per se. He's interested in trees and mountains as symbolic of the spirit, or perhaps going back, symbolic of that unknown. This is in 1930. So, yes, somebody like Lauren Harris and somebody like Kandinsky did say, were saying that what they were painting was actually things that they were seeing, not seeing with their eye outward, but seeing with their eye inward, seeing with their soul.
What if Ann Davis has it only half right? What if Lauren Harris actually painted what he saw, not with the mind's eye, but what actually manifested itself in his visual field? In a moment, I'll present some evidence to suggest that's exactly what happened.
This is Ideas on CBC Radio 1. I'm Paul Kennedy. Tonight, the first of a two-part series, Visions and Voices. The program is written and presented by the host of Tapestry, Dawn Hill.
In 1998, I was commissioned by CBC Television to write an outline for a show, reconstructing the correspondence between the artist Emily Carr and Lauren Harris. Some of the letters were missing and were considered lost. A couple of tantalizing clues, overlooked by art historians, persuaded me to hit the road and follow up on a hunch. I haven't found what I'm looking for, not yet. But I did travel just about everywhere Lauren Harris went in North America, New Hampshire, Colorado, BC and Alberta. I experienced the landscape as he might have, got a sense of what he saw, and must have felt in the sacred places he visited. Even sat on a bus for 2 days, retracing his trip to Santa Fe from Chicago down the old Route 66, the road he would have taken. And I visited people, artists who knew Lauren Harris, and academics who know things about his art. The latter works of Lauren Harris, those mysterious squiggles of paint laden over with precise geometry, are rarely discussed by art historians, and they're pretty much forgotten by the public. His paintings, with a group of seven, more fondly recalled. Harris could have cared less.
If you look at his painting, and I admired his painting so much, his art so much, he was the one that, at that time, didn't have very much interest in his past, in the early days of the Group of Seven.
Gordon Smith is a prominent West Coast artist. He and his wife Marion knew Lauren Harris, enjoyed a close friendship in Vancouver until his death in 1970.
Harris always kept, he had all his antennas going, you know, and I think that it was pretty daring at the time, and still they think, a lot of people discount the abstract paintings of Harris, you know, which is very sad. I mean, they were put aside, but I think some of those paintings of the abstract paintings are beautiful, beautiful paintings.
We're thumbing through photo albums, memorabilia, art prints, and catalogs. Some of the simple line drawings Lauren Harris made in the 1940s catch my eye. They look a lot like the images I've seen painted on canyon walls and cliff faces, and a couple are dead ringers for the rock art I've seen in my travels. Then Marion Smith points to an austere yet hauntingly beautiful image. It's a painting by Lauren Harris, one of his last.
Well, used to be in his living room, on the easel, on the easel.
I saw him painting.
So interesting you say
but that. That was the one you saw?
Oh, yes, and he was working on that towards the end of his life.
I think it's wonderful.
It has all the markings of a theosophical thought form, stark geometry, colored with a luminous kind of ochre floating in the middle distance. And it occurred to me, then and there, that Harris, like a shaman in trance, must have seen this image, taking it all in, whole. He painted what he saw. And I said as much to Gordon Smith, his longtime friend and a fellow artist.
I think that's the most significant statement I've heard yet about that, summarizing it. I think that's very good.
Those paintings, and other people used to think Lauren was senile by that time.
Or had lost it completely.
Yeah. And, well, one nice person we knew said we should just admit, you know, but we never thought that. And Gordon always appreciated those paintings very much. And that particular one, we didn't know why we did.
Well, that, to me, that last painting he did was one of the most beautiful paintings I've seen, that one.
I think it was in touch with his own spirit and his spiritual side. And he spoke of these experiences with great enthusiasm.
That's Arthur Erickson. As a young man, the future architect was a regular guest at the Harris home in Vancouver. So I put the same question to him. Did Lauren Harris paint what he saw? Are his latter works, his abstractions, in fact, representational works of art?
Yeah, I think they were consciously that. I know Lauren, whenever he did a new painting and I saw something and I'd be admiring it, and either Lauren or Bess would say, well, you know, this is the result of a spiritual experience in the mountains, mostly. And there was always a lot of conversation about the experiences they had in the mountains, which were the exhilaration of extraordinary space and the presence of the spirit. You felt it was something that they were involved with. It was terribly important. They felt it was the most revelatory information possible.
That Lauren Harris was in contact with forces larger than himself is hinted at again and again in his journals. This bit of critical writing published in an art magazine jumped out at me. "Art is the beginning of vision," Harris wrote in his book review of Cosmic Consciousness, now considered a classic of arcane literature. "There is a logic of ecstasy, and this higher logic is the only one worthy of consideration," Harris advised. "Art is the beginning of vision into the realm of higher life." It's probable that rock art marks the recollection of the shaman's journey through states of consciousness, not just dreams, not just death. The recordings are of a lucid jaunt through waking states where one is never certain if they're the center of their own experience, encounters with aha moments, cartoonish, surreal, amplified, sometimes overpowering and life-changing. So what is one to make of modern compositions that depict entoptic imagery, stuff that appears to be a facsimile of rock art? Marine Korp lectures widely on the history of religion and art history. Her recent book, Sacred Art of the Earth, is based upon a questionnaire completed by over 100 artists.
They were having dreams, visions, paranormal experiences, which I asked about in my questionnaire. They were more than willing to tell about them, and they were, as the analysis showed, much more likely to be influenced by the information they obtained through these extraordinary means than through any life crisis or life event. In other words, they weren't about to go chopping off their ears and jumping off bridges because they were artists, because they were driven by their visions to map them in some way for others. They spoke of themselves as mediums, and they meant it. Then I took those descriptions of paranormal experiences, and many of them were rather familiar things. I mean, we've all had instances of ESP. Well, we're thinking about somebody, the phone rings, isn't that marvelous? And I put them into categories, and some of them were unusual. Out-of-body experiences are not, you know, everyday things. I had a leftover group that I didn't know what to do with, and they were of a sort with intensification of color. Generally of color, sometimes of line, sometimes of object, but there was an intensification of visual perception.
Amplified to almost cartoonish looking and very thick lines and intense, in some cases, pulsating colors.
All of that. So here I had this little group. I had gotten my categories by checking with a psychologist to find out what the approved definitions were, and this group wasn't in there. So I called him up. And I said, "Bruce, I got this little category, about 6 or 7 of these left over, and I don't know what to do with them, and here's what they sound like." And I read the written descriptions out to him. And he said, that's called ecstasy. I said, "Come again?" He said, "Ecstasy, it's a paranormal category." So I took a deep breath, and I said, "Bruce, if I am walking along the street and the light hits a leaf in a particular sort of way and I happen to catch it and it gives my day a little lift, in fact, I might stare at it for a while and get really, you know, into just delighting in the way that leaf is looking and the light is hitting it, and I might even start to think about writing a poem about that since I am a poet. That is called ecstasy." He said, "Yeah, it's a paranormal category." I said, "I can't believe this." I said, "This is a guaranteed event in my life a couple of times a week."
The only thing you need as a painter in terms of a technology or technique is the ability to kind of make those transformations. And it's really the transformations between, you know, parts of the painting or learning to recognize what it is. So the process is kind of like, yes, no, okay, that's it. No, that's not it. Okay, get rid of that. Okay, I'm getting somewhere. So it's not exactly hard science.
This is Landon McKenzie. She lives in Vancouver and teaches at the Emily Carr Institute of Art and Design. Her large canvases are collected in major galleries around the world.
So if you have Harris in the desert pretending that he's actually painting the mountain that's in front of him, because a lot of the artists from that era were kind of geared up to paint observationally, of course they leave it the minute they enter the realm of the wet, sticky stuff. So when you talk about representational space versus abstract space, you could argue that all work is abstract, even if it looks representational. You could argue that all representational painting is abstract, or you could argue the opposite, that all abstract painting is representational, because basically it's the service of a color, a mark, and a shape to kind of allude to another idea. And then people bring their completion. So in one part of the painting, there may be this blue and gold kind of blob. Now, I don't know exactly what that is, but I've kept it because I can't name it, but I can recognize it.
Landon McKenzie's art is concerned with myth-making and how stories rooted in a sense of place, the landscape, appear, disappear, and yet somehow can be accounted for over time. Some of her ideas remind me of David Hockney's work, and I tell her about one piece of his I particularly like, a photomontage. It's a single scene that's been photographed over a period of a few years. The angle is the same. So is the subject matter, a person in a fixed pose. Yet the image I'm looking at is a mosaic, a composite of all the photographs taken. They've been ripped up, mixed up, and reassembled like an interlocking jigsaw puzzle. It's a clever statement. Multiples of an image taken at different times assemble into a frozen, unique moment, an aesthetic I understand in the here and now. And while the depiction of the person initially draws my attention, it's the details around the principal subject that tell a bigger story. It's like seeing all of this person's time all at once. Kind of like the feeling I have when visiting a rock art site, the timeless sense of being in a place that's been witness to many, many people. I can feel their presence there. Marine Corp.
I asked one question that was a key question in the survey. I asked whether the artist had had experience in a particular place, a sense of ancient times or powers. The response rate was astounding. 79% of the artists had had those experiences. And because it was an open-ended questionnaire and there was plenty of space for them to write, they wrote. And they wrote, and they wrote, and they wrote, and they wrote things about how these experiences had taught them that there was no such thing as heaven or hell, that life continued, that one artist put it memorably, nature doesn't waste energy. That's how I discovered that what I had been taught in school as artistic vision, meaning the artist has a good idea, goes to the studio and does something about it, was erroneous, that artistic vision actually was visual. It was something the artist could see and attempted to find a way to map for other people so that the viewer or the participant in the environment, if that person would take the time to look and to look long enough to trace the lines, to trace the colors, to walk the steps, that you move into the mentality of the person who made that event, and at that point you're replicating some of that information and you begin to trade a storyline, if you will, back and forth. That is remarkable, but it happens across time and it happens across culture. And now I understand why it is that people go to places and know things that they shouldn't be able to know just from reading the guidebook.
Cultures around the globe, says Olga Lochikova, a professor of psychology and religion, have regarded certain places, mostly mountains, as sacred. And rock art tends to show up around many of these locales. This marks them as a power spot. Dr. Luchakova and her colleague Igor Kongertsev earned their degrees in St. Petersburg, Russia, and have traveled extensively studying mystical traditions and how different regions of the earth affect people's state of mind and their spiritual practices. In Slavic pagan sorcery, the whole body was used as a refined instrument for perceiving the energy of the earth, trees, rocks, and streams, Dr. Kongertsev said. In other words, the planet, all of creation, communicates to those who can hear and reveals itself to those who can see. Dean Radin, author of The Conscious Universe.
A case can be made that indigenous peoples and shamans of old were the scientists of their days. And simply through virtue of their own body and their own perception, were able to identify that some spots were different than others, and different in certain ways. I mean, there are all kinds of different places you can be, but these places that later were called sacred spots or power spots were probably felt to produce the kinds of altered states of consciousness that the shaman wanted to produce.
I'm not certain if there are any contemporary rock art locations. I haven't seen any. It's as if the shamans went underground, while we, in the dominant culture, buried ourselves in materialism. Where did the dreams go? The rock seems silent now, and yet it beckons. That's why I traveled to northern Saskatchewan by bushplane and canoe to be in the presence of the shaman's pictographs. What if rock art is a kind of El Dorado, its secrets hidden in plain view for all to see? And for those who can see, they begin to see once more. For those who can hear, the story reveals itself. All human beings have the capacity to experience trance states, and because our brains are pretty much the same as they've been for many millennia, is it possible to get into the state of mind of shamans long ago? Experience their world. Hear the story. See it once more. Dave Whitley.
When Native American commentary tells us time and time again that rock art sites were vision quest sites, that they portrayed the visionary imagery that they saw in their supernatural experiences, I must believe that. And I think it's extremely ethnocentric not to. But the other bit of controversy concerns the idea of whether or not we can reconstruct aspects of the minds of prehistoric people. And frankly, my profession, archaeology, has long felt that prehistoric mind is entirely inaccessible. I think they're wrong. The mountains agree.
It was an auspicious moment. Dr. Whitley and I, startled by the loud boom, wondered what else the mountains on the edge of the Mojave Desert might have to say.
Tonight on Ideas, you've listened to part one of Visions and Voices by Don Hill. The series continues a week from today. This program was produced with the assistance of Linda Shorten. Technical assistance provided by Dave Field. You can purchase either a transcript or a cassette copy of this two-part series. The transcript costs $14 and the cassettes cost $26, taxes and shipping included. To order, call this number, area code 416-205-7367. That's 416-205-7367. Or you can send a check or money order to Ideas, CBC Radio 1, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Our email address is ideas@cbc.ca. The executive producer of Ideas is Richard Handler, and I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 for the hourly news, followed by the Arts Today and Between the Covers.